Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back. This morning, Senator Reid, in his remarks, noted the breadth of support for clean energy from T. Boone Pickens to Al Gore. And again, this morning we heard from Boone Pickens, and I'm about to read you a letter from former Vice President Al Gore. I think, please, that deserves a round of applause. I think that no one clearly has done more to educate, to change people's minds, to give people information about the climate crisis than Vice President Gore. For that, as Senator Reid noted, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize along with the scientists that make up the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I think I just always like to remind people of this, that this was not the Nobel Prize for chemistry. It was not the Nobel Prize for physics or the Nobel Prize for environmental protection. It was the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think it's important for us to reflect on the fact that the Nobel Committee looked out over the horizon and saw the chaos that would result from a world that in which we saw climate-induced human migration, increased food shortages, water insecurity, destructive weather events, really disrupting the whole way that we think about the concept of globalization in today's world. And for that, they said, we got to get on with it. And I think that that's what the purpose of this summit is, which is to get on with the transformation of our energy future to avoid those worst results. So let me read you this letter from Senator Gore, from Vice President Gore. I'm so sorry that I'm unable to join you in person today. I'm at my home in Tennessee with my whole family today celebrating Tipper's birthday. It's my pleasure to thank you all for participating in today's Clean Energy Summit and your commitment to help move America toward a clean energy future. If we resolve ourselves, we can create a clean energy revolution that will generate hundreds of thousands of jobs, strengthen our economy, reduce our reliance on coal and oil, and help solve the climate crisis. But it will take all of us. I hope that when the summit concludes, you will have established a set of guiding principles to help shape energy policies of the next administration and policy leaders at all levels. It's fitting that Nevada is hosting the National Clean Energy Summit. Nevada is at the heart of a debate about how America should generate and use energy in the future. And Nevada has abundant clean energy sources, such as the geothermal, solar, and wind power, which are at the heart of the solution. And of course, Nevada is the home of my good friend, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, whose leadership on this issue is critical. Thank you for your commitment, signed Vice President Gore. I would note that the Vice President chairs the Alliance for Climate Protection, and I would urge you all, if you haven't done so already, to go visit their website, www.wecansolveit.org, which has a lot of tremendously useful information. He's put together a tremendous coalition of leaders and ordinary citizens to try to help us move this forward. Now, to fully round out the homecoming feeling of the Clinton-Gore administration, it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Bob Rubin. Robert E. Rubin joined the Clinton administration in 1993, serving in the White House as assistant to the President for Economic Policy and the first director of the National Economic Council. In that job, for those of us who served in the White House, we know this well, he steered the process that led to President Clinton's first economic plan and an astounding, I think, economic performance following passage of that plan in 1993, turning record deficits into a record surplus. We saw the creation of 23 million jobs in our country, real wage growth from top to bottom, which hadn't occurred, particularly at the bottom and mid-levels of our workforce in more than a decade. So it was really quite an astounding performance, and I think for that it won the moniker Rubinomics. He then served with great distinction as our nation's 70th Secretary of the Treasury from January 10, 1995 until July 2, 1999. In 1999, he joined Citi as Director and Chairman of the Executive Committee of the Board of Citi. He's Chairman of the Board of the Local Initiative Support Corporation, LIST, the nation's leading community development support organization. In June 2007, he was named co-chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. Bob's going to broaden our discussion and set the clean energy debate in the context of our country's broader economic challenges. So please join me in welcoming Bob Rubin.
Thank you, John. Let me just say that John Podesta has been a really important person in the, not only was he very important in our administration, but very important in American public policy ever since, and it's a pleasure to be with him. He recited the achievements of the 1990s, and I can assure you if President Clinton were here, he would say that he was, and rightly would say, that he was responsible for every one of them. In any event, it was a great thing to be part of the Clinton team. It was a great thing to work with John Podesta, and I'm delighted to be with you all today. I'm going to divide my brief remarks into three parts. Firstly, my views, the outlook for the U.S. economy for the short term and the long term, partly because that is the framework within which you're thinking about what is an extremely important part of future economic policy, energy, and partly because with today's conditions, I think all of us are very interested and feel a very pressing sense about what is going on in our economy. Secondly, fleshing out the reasons why I believe that we have to end our endless debates about energy and act now. And thirdly, some thoughts on policy with respect to acting on energy. Let me start with a short-term outlook for the U.S. economy. We are currently, as all of you well know, experiencing difficult conditions, and that began with a confluence of multiple factors that led to a perfect storm in the credit markets, pushed us into uncharted territory, and in my view at least, has created the most complicated and perhaps the most serious situation in U.S. credit markets in the last 50 years. After that, consumption began to run into serious headwinds with massively increased oil prices, declining housing prices, tight credit, high levels of consumer debt, a large incidence of troubled mortgages, and much else. And all of this is now creating the question, or one question now, one risk now, is where will all of this lead in terms of the overall economy? And at least one possibility, and hopefully the probability of this is low, but one possibility is that all of this could lead to much more serious difficulty in the economy itself, which then would feed back into the credit markets and into consumption. And finally, in terms of the risks, many foreign economies have behaved relatively well, but there's been some weakening in many parts of the world, and one risk is that that heightens. Having said all that, there are also great strengths in the U.S. economy. We have strong corporate balance sheets. We've had strong exports. There's an enormous amount of cash around the world, and at some point, that cash will decide to go back into the markets when that cash feels that prices are cheap enough. And finally, as I mentioned a moment ago, many foreign economies have been doing reasonably well, actually quite well, although in the most recent past, there's been some weakening. When you put this all together, I at least think that the most likely scenario for the short term, that is looking out over the next year or year and a half, is a continuation of today's conditions, or perhaps conditions slightly worse than, or somewhat worse than today's. There is certainly some possibility, though I think the probability is low, of a much more rapid recovery. And there is some possibility, and here one has to hope that the probability is low, that all the negatives will come together that I mentioned before and create a mutually reinforcing negative interaction. It seems to me that the conclusion that we draw from this, if we're investors, is to weigh risk very, very seriously in our decisions. And if we are going to do opportunistic buying, if we are going to do some opportunistic buying because we think prices are cheap relative to long-term value, and I know some very shrewd people have begun doing this, then that buying should be paced, and it should only be done if you feel you can weather the possibility of difficulty for a considerable period of time. From a policy point of view, I think the conclusion is absolutely clear, and it's what Senator Obama said at the meeting he had with economic advisors a couple of weeks ago, which is that we need to be highly proactive in continuing to look for ways to address the current duress with respect to tight credit, with respect to mortgages, and very importantly, with respect to the issue that you all are here to discuss, oil prices. With that, let me turn to the long term, which is, I think, the more pertinent framework in terms of thinking about energy policy. To start, the global economy is undergoing a transformation of truly historic proportions, the greatest change surely since the emergence of the United States over 100 years ago, and perhaps the greatest change since the Industrial Revolution. It involves new technologies, it involves globalization, it involves the adoption of market-based economics and productivity-enhancing policies in China, India, and elsewhere that are leading those emerging market nations to become major forces in the global economy, and much else. These developments have greatly benefited our economy, but they also have created increased competitive pressure, increased pressure on wages, and increased pressure on job insecurity. That said, the United States has enormous long-term strengths. Our historical embrace of change, the flexibility of our economy, our willingness to take risk, our sheer size. We can build on all these strengths, and if we do, we can thrive in this rapidly changing global environment. But to do that, we must meet hugely consequential challenges. John Podesta and I were just talking about what I'm about to say. The next president of the United States is going to face a wide array of truly critical issues as to the economy, as to national security, as to the environment, and so much else. Any president at any stage in their presidency has a limited amount of political capital and a limited institutional capacity. And the next president is going to have to decide to pursue a few of these critical issues and to defer most of them. On the domestic side, in addition to addressing our short-term economic duress, I think there are two issues that will absolutely force themselves on the new president: reestablishing sound, long-term fiscal conditions, and energy. As to energy, let me briefly list the reasons why I believe, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, we have got to stop having endless debates, and we have to act and act now. One, current oil prices are taking an enormous toll on our economy, and if this continues and it combines with our current dependence on oil, that will be a serious threat to our economic future. Two, virtually all mainstream economists agree that humanly caused global warming is a high probability threat of enormous consequence. Three, the movement of the populations of China, India, and elsewhere toward Western-style standards of living is going to create continued and ever greater pressure on oil prices and create a real possibility of scarcity leading to a constraint on growth. Four, current oil prices are creating a massive wealth shift to the oil-producing countries, and that potentially has enormous economic and geopolitical consequences. Five, high oil prices are contributing greatly to our large trade imbalances, and those trade imbalances are a serious risk to our future economic well-being. High oil prices are a disaster to poor countries that don't have oil resources. A substantial share of global production occurs in areas that are subject to political turmoil, geopolitical turmoil, all of which could create a major oil shock. Relatedly, competition for oil resources or geopolitical or political turmoil could lead to periodic and extensive U.S. military involvement. You put these all together, and it seems to me the case for acting now is absolutely clear. Having said all that, I don't think there's any question that we have the capacity to do what is needed. The question is, do we have the will? And the will means, do we have the ability to make the politically difficult choices that are requisite if we're going to move forward, instead of opting for kicking the can down the road or opting for easy choices that create the illusion of security? If we do what we need to do, there is also an enormous economic opportunity in all this to make the United States the center of what are going to be enormous industries around alternatives to oil, conservation, and efficiency, industries that many of you all here are involved with. That'll include technology, equipment, intellectual property, professional service, and the provision of energy itself. Moreover, the United States has very substantial comparative advantages in the competition to become the center of these industries. Most of the world's great universities are located in this country. These centers of basic and applied research in this country are oriented toward commercial application. We have vast natural resources in the form of wind, solar heat, massive coal deposits for clean coal-burning technologies. We have an enormous capacity to grow crops that can be converted into energy. We have a flexible economy, and we have a huge market. There are many policy issues around moving to alternatives, conservation, and efficiency. For example, protecting the poor and income distribution. But in the limited time I have, I'm going to focus on two interrelated issues. One, affecting behavior with respect to energy use, and two, bringing the power of private capital to bear on creating robust regimes in alternatives, conservation, and efficiency. To start with, there are vast amounts of private capital around the world that have now become accustomed to investing in unconventional ways and are thus potentially available to invest in pursuing these objectives. Those investment decisions, as you all well know, are going to be based on calculations of risk, reward, and probability, and then as a consequence of all that, probability-weighted returns. Public policy has a critical role to play in providing the factors that will affect those calculations that markets, by their very nature, will not provide. In the interest of time, let me simply list a number of these areas that could be central to affecting behavior and central to catalyzing private investment. One, a serious cap and trade regime with permits auctioned off to promote market demand for alternatives and for conservation. Two, support for basic research, pilot projects, and the like to create the intellectual capital that is central to private sector activity in the ways that markets, by their very nature, again, will not provide. I don't think there's any question that other countries are going to invest in this basic research, the question, and pilot projects. The question is, will we? Tax credits for activities that have economic benefits that markets won't capture. Programs to help key industries, key traditional industries, adapt to the new conditions in energy and to retool in ways that once again provide benefit, economic benefit, that markets don't capture. An example would be the automobile industry. In terms of providing hybrids, retooling to provide hybrids, electric cars, and other types of energy saving change. We have to have intellectual property regimes that protect the output from private investment, but at the same time, meet the needs of poor countries that need these products, but could only acquire them at low prices. We need reform of our trade policy that removes impediments to importing raw material for renewables and the energy that is produced from those raw materials. We have the opportunity to use our vast government purchasing power to create markets for alternatives and conservation. We need, at least in my view, to remove undue political and regulatory impediments to timely approval for clean energy products. For example, safe use of nuclear power, location of wind farms, and clean coal burning. And to name just one more, we need an immigration policy that will enable us to continue to attract the best and the brightest of students around the world in the areas that relate to clean energy and also the professionals from around the world that can staff our clean energy industries. Let me make one overall comment with respect to all the policies I've just mentioned. Investors, as you know, like certainty, and they demand high returns in the face of uncertainty. A challenge with respect to all of these policies will be to create an environment where investors feel that they can rely on the policies that are in place, remaining in place for the long term, rather than feeling that policies will change as politicians change and as elections occur. I also think that in all these policy areas, we need to focus on trying to develop measures that will help meet another major policy challenge in all of this effort around clean energy, and that is bringing China, India, and the rest of the emerging market world into the clean energy effort. As you know, oil drilling is a very current subject. Obviously, one issue here is the ecological sensitivity in some of the areas being proposed for drilling. But beyond that, there's another concern that I have. And that is that, as I've already said, I think that clean energy and the policy initiatives relating to clean energy are going to be very, very difficult politically. And one of the concerns I have is that an expansion of oil drilling may create a false sense of security about our energy future, and in that way, undermine the political will to do what we need to pursue clean energy. Let me conclude by saying that some of the benefits of a clean energy regime will occur relatively quickly. Current high oil prices have many adverse effects, but they have had some favorable effects in terms of energy conservation and energy alternatives. Most of the benefits obviously will phase in over time, and the challenge to our political system is to exercise a long-term will to persist on a massive scale. And I think that finding ways to create that long-term political will in the political system is the most fundamental, the most important, and the most difficult challenge with respect to clean energy. If we can do that, if we can meet the political challenge, we can do all the rest. And if we don't meet the political challenge, all the good policy work in the world isn't going to matter. And just as a closing note, I think conferences such as you're having here today with Senator Reid are exactly what we need to do. And I think in that respect, all of us can try to help, continue to help, to increase public awareness of the importance of the mission that you are about, and in that way, influence our political system. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bob. Okay. My mic is now working. Bob has time for just a couple of questions. And so I think we have people with mics that are going around, but I actually want to pose the first question. We've had quite a bit of debate about the short-term nature of the production tax credits and investment tax credits for renewables, and they trigger on, they trigger off. If you look at the investment on the portfolios, it looks like a yo-yo, if you will. And speaking as the former Secretary of the Treasury, What's the planning horizon that businesses really need in order to invest in those kind of technologies?
Well, some of you here know a lot more about investing in renewables than I do, but my impression, John, is that I think that for the tax credits to have the effect that you want to have, I think they should be put in place just like the research and R&D credits should be put in place on a permanent basis. But let me say there are no free lunches in life. And one of the problems is, if you're going to do the kinds of things that you all want to do, and I think you're absolutely right in wanting to do them, you've got to find ways to pay for them, either by reducing other spending or by creating revenues.
Okay. We have a mic over there. Please identify yourself.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Tarbotten from Rainforest Action Network. Mr. Rubin, I have a question for you in your capacity with Citi. And I really appreciated your remarks about the policy needs to shift us towards a renewable future. And I'm wondering how you rectify that need for a really dramatic turn in direction with the fact that Citigroup is, in fact, the largest financier of the coal industry, and specifically utilities building coal-fired power plants. And in the last 6 months alone, did 10 deals with utilities building coal-fired power plants, none of which will be, as you said, clean burning. I just wanted you to speak a little bit to your opinions on the role you see your bank taking.
Let me give you a two-part answer. It's a commercial institution, and it is, you know, commercially oriented. And this is, we've got to have energy, and it doesn't. And that's how banks operate and commercial institutions operate. Having said that, they have been very serious about trying, and I think actually been working with you all. I'm quite sure they have. Pam Flaherty, who runs the foundation at Citi, as I understand it, been working very closely with the Rainforest Action Network in trying to create standards and to create a different kind of regime in the credit extending world, and I think you're right to continue to move in that direction, and hopefully that's the direction in which credit extension will evolve.
So just a quick follow-up, can we expect to see a dramatic drop-off in cities' investments in coal-fired power plants in the coming months, years?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, truthfully, I can't speak for Citi. I have a sort of a advisory consulting. Well, I'm an executive of the company, but I have a very advisory role. But if you had to ask me to make a prediction, a dramatic reduction in the coming months, I wouldn't think so. Hopefully, the whole regime around coal will evolve over time, and over time, you will have a dramatic change from what the kinds of coal burning facilities are creating now to clean coal.
Okay. Other questions?
My name is Judy Dugan, and you mentioned that there were regulatory impediments to coal. You talked about removing regulatory impediments to nuclear, to clean coal, but clean coal has not proven any capability to be commercially scalable.
I think that's right, and you're correct. And in the first instance, and this is not, there are many people who know more about clean coal than I do. Based on a little bit I know, I think the predicate to moving ahead on clean coal is developing the technology and the intellectual work product that you would need to create for carbon capture and then clean coal. That's correct.
Got any more?
On the other hand, if you can ever get there, this country has these enormous coal resources, but you are absolutely right. The intellectual work product doesn't yet, at least as I understand it, is still very much a work in process.
Okay, last question right here.
Hi, my name is Peggy Mays Johnson. I guess I'm very concerned about, you're talking about reducing regulatory impediments. I think that the regulatory impediments, as you call them, have saved our butts from things like the coal-fired plant that they want to do at the Ely Energy Center. Yucca Mountain is...
Yeah. By the way, I didn't say regulatory impediments. I said undue regulatory impediments.
Well, that's, I think that's semantics. I think you can say that somebody will say that any regulatory is undue.
Yeah, and somebody will say that undue means that which is not due.
I mean, I think without those quote-unquote undue regulatory impediments, we might have Yucca Mountain here today, which would make this not a great venue.
I agree.
For a national clean energy summit. And so I think that we have to be really careful when we talk about eliminating or reducing regulatory proposals.
Well,
I think that they're just incredibly important.
Well, that's fair enough. On the other hand, it's very hard to build a wind farm in the United States today. And there are a lot of places I suspect we could build wind farms, and it would be a good thing to build them. And if it takes forever to build them, then people aren't going to invest in them. Yes, ma'am.
I agree, but it also means, and luckily we have these undue regulations, regulatory impediments that are keeping us right now from building any more nuclear power plants, which I said earlier, I think that we ought not to call clean energy, certainly not affordable energy. And I think that we need to take a real look at how we are looking at clean energy, clean coal, clean nuclear. I just think some of us have a problem with that.
No, that's fair. Okay. No, that's fair enough, and that's the debate. I mean, I don't know the number. Maybe you do, John, of what percentage of electric power in France is nuclear power, is nuclear-based? About 80, yeah. It's a large percentage. They've obviously made a different set of decisions. But that's the debate. But I don't disagree with you. I mean, that's the debate we should have.
Okay.
No, you're right to you're right to raise the question. I think these are the debates we should have. Then we should find some process to bring them to conclusion and then move ahead. So I agree with you in bringing the point to the debate, but we could also have endless debates and never do anything, and that's not good either.
I guess.
And that will be part of the debate. So I agree with you. I don't agree necessarily with your conclusion, but I agree with you. That will be the debate. That's the debate. We need to find processes to debate these very complicated issues, and then we have to have some process in our political system to bring it to closure, and then when we have closure, some people can move ahead, and maybe they'll decide they do want to do nuclear, maybe they decide they won't. Wind farms, there's plenty of wind in Capitol Hill, but we need a different kind of wind. We need kind of a more constructive wind.
I think, just to have the final word on this, I think that what's clear is that what set of policies that ultimately the Congress passes, that states pass, are critical in whether we're going to have a future that's built on wind, solar, geothermal, the clean energy technologies that we've talked about, or we're going to build in incentives for more coal-fired power plants, more nuclear power, et cetera. And that's, as I think the Secretary noted, that's a debate that this country needs to have, and that's one that we're having in the context of the campaign going forward. And ultimately in January, I think the American people, as I read the polling, which I do on some occasions, the American public really wants to see that push towards these clean technologies. So,
just one comment? Yeah, but I think we'd all agree. I think we'd all agree we've got to move away from oil. And then the context is, you know, where do you, in what way do you do that? And you're raising perfectly legitimate points on where you would move and not move.
Please join me in thanking Secretary Rubin for being here today. Thank you.